Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
and I want to thank everybody involved in getting me here, Diz and Nancy for picking me up at the airport, and Tommy and Brenda for making the weekend go easy for me, and everybody else involved. And this guy here, Creighton, for taking me down. You all know Creighton, don't you? You will. He was nice enough to take me around the town today. We saw Climax and Cairo and I don't know. It was a wild day. I mean, we had to pace ourselves because there was a lot of it, you know. And you know, I love the instructions they give to alcoholics. The alcoholics are about as self-surviving as you can be. And to hear Diz say, "Well, in case of a fire," it's like the airlines we got. You know, and if you need to go to the restrooms, they're marked restrooms, like over here. I love it. I just love it. I just love being sober. I mean, I don't know how anybody could not be enjoying yourself. I mean, this is just unbelievable to me. This is the 15th of March. It's 2003. I've never done the 15th of March, 2003. And so my job is like to squeeze it so when it's over and I put it to bed, you know, it's done for the day. I don't want to carry the 14th into the 15th. You know, some people have a habit of doing that. You know, they talk like, well, when I first arrived in my mother's womb, you know, I can't go back that far. I'm sorry, you know. I don't go back very far to what it was like in drinking, because most of my drinking I don't remember. You know, I really just don't remember. And the stuff I remember most vividly in sobriety never happened. So it just doesn't leave you much of a story, you know. I was born and raised in Brooklyn in one of those neighborhoods where you used to say, "How far is it to the subway?" And they said, "We don't know. No one's ever made it, you know." You know? And they used to say things like, "Hey, he fell asleep in the trunk of a car, he deserved to be shot." You know, like, it was 85% of the suicides in my neighborhood were assisted, you know. I don't understand a lot of that way, way back stuff. I'm the youngest of seven kids. My mom raised seven kids, and all I can tell you is my family's divided into two groups. Either you're in AA or you need it. You know, like there's absolutely no middle ground, you know. My mom was not a drinker. My dad died of this disease and at 50. And my mom used to say the only time you kids say no to a drink is if you misunderstood the question. You know, like, you know, my son said he was 6 years old before he realized his name wasn't Get Me One. You know, like Get Me One. You know, like, you know. So... I went off and I got married, and I married the most normal woman you could possibly marry. And she would say, you know, some of the dumbest things to me. Like, first of all, she'd say, you know, "Maybe you're drinking too much." I never knew what too much was, you know. And then sometimes she'd say to me, you know, "That's your second drink. That's your second drink." And I used to look and say, "Honey, why don't you just go ahead and finish your breakfast?" And, you know, like, this, you know, like, and I'll finish mine, you know, like, but we had like trouble communicating, you know. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, those of you who read it, it says some wonderful things about us. It says that we're delusional people. It says we're insane. We're in full flight from reality. We're outright mental defectives. We're producers of confusion, you know, in our best moments, and we're children of chaos, and that's what we're working with, you know, like, you know, those are the highlights, you know. That's who you are, you know, And I heard Bob last night. I want to tell all the speakers I enjoyed them, Bob, last night, and then Laura and Roberta today. I enjoyed every one of them. But I heard Bob say that he worked a little bit with professional people, getting some professional help. I was court-ordered one time to a psychiatrist. That ought to tell you something right there. And he said to me, "What are you thinking about right now?" Because I wasn't very involved in the process that they had me involved in. And he said, "Just tell me what you're thinking right now." And I didn't think it would help my cause to tell him that at that exact moment I was thinking, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like? You know? And I figured, maybe I'll hold back a little bit, you know, like, you know, I don't want to give him too much to work with, you know. Then right after that, I was thinking, if I could starch my tie, it would always look like I was moving, even when I was sitting down, you know. And like, I just thought, I better pace myself. The good doctor here may misconstrue that, you know. And I'm like most alcoholics of my ilk, you know, I ended up going to college, and I got through college playing sports, but I got through school totally unscarred by education, you know. It never landed a blow on me. I was about 20 years old before I realized that Moby Dick was not a venereal disease, you know, like I was just, that's just the way it was. I had no concept. I had no concept of what was going on, you know, and it was, you know, fortunately, I got sober with and hang out guys just like that. You know, when we have countdowns for sobriety, we go, you know, you say to Mike, you know, the guys I hang out with, there's a dead bird, they all look up. That's just the kind of guys they are. I took one of our guys to a sporting goods store to get some bowling trophies, and he looked around and he goes, "Wow, is this guy good?" You know? But you get a flavor for the kind of folks I was hanging out with, you know? And I love to hear people laugh. That's the only reason I'm willing to go through all the stuff that we go through to come to these conventions anymore on the planes, is that I love to hear people laugh. Because I know two things about laughter that most people don't know. The first being is that when you're laughing, it's impossible to think. You cannot laugh and think at the same time. It's impossible. So every time you're laughing, you're getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you, you know? And God knows you guys need the respite, you know, like, if there were a song in AA, it would be, "I'm always on my mind, I'm always on my mind," you know. And the second thing I know is that when you're laughing, it produces a lot of endorphins in your system, and it makes you very healthy. I mean, it builds up your immune system, it clears up your mind, it just makes you healthy. And so the whole idea is to be around people who are laughing. Our literature tells us happy people don't hurt other people. It's people who are not happy who hurt other people. And I have on my mind tonight, I have my sponsor because I've had the same sponsor since I got sober. I met him at the very first meeting I went to. And if I can hang out here till July, I'll be 33 years sober with one sponsor. And there aren't that many people who get that opportunity. And I just found out this week that he has cancer of the spine and that he's going through some radiation treatment. And he and I were on the phone, and you would have thought we were talking about going on holiday rather than him possibly cashing in his chips. And the reason for that is that when you live totally in the moment, which is what this book tells us to do, when you live totally in the moment, then what comes next really doesn't scare you because there is no next. You know, I hear people talk about there and then. There is no there and then. There's only here and now. When you get to there and then, it's here and now. You know, this is not complicated stuff. You know, we don't say we do this program one millennium at a time. You know, it's a day at a time, you know. And, you know, and the whole thing is summed up in God. The reason that for years I used to hear people talk about spiritual malady, and I never knew quite what that was. I heard people give me their interpretations of spiritual malady, but I never knew quite what it was. And today, for me, my experience is I know what the spiritual malady is. The spiritual malady is not living in the moment. When you're not in the moment, you have the spiritual malady. And alcoholics, if you listen to them share, their whole life is about what's going to happen and what did happen. It's never about what is happening, or very seldom. And that's the only place we can live, in the now. In fact, if you take the word now and you spell it backwards, it's one, W-O-N. When you've learned to live in the now, you've won. This is the whole deal. And we write about it in our book, and we say, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him Thursday. You know, like, and the deal is, everything is about this moment and this moment only. And that's fortunately what I've picked up in the last several years. And that's what I'll share with you hopefully tonight, is that this is where I live my life. My life isn't about what used to happen, because it doesn't happen anymore. And it's not about what might happen, because who knows what might happen. Are you really sure that this is the day you planned for 10 years ago? I don't think so. You know, and I hear people say that, you know, all kinds of things. And it makes sense at the time, and I even buy into some of it, but then my own experience later on isn't that way. When I first got here, I used to say things like, I lost everything and I was left with nothing. And after 30-plus years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you, the everything that I lost has turned out to be nothing. And the nothing I have been left with has turned out to be everything. And I couldn't see that when you first get here. You know, the guys who wrote this book, Bill and Bob and those guys, they knew what was happening. They were not only alcoholics, but they had a good street sense about them, too. They had this spiritual thing down to the point where they understood that you can't give too big of a layer of spiritual stuff to alcoholics because, you know, they drowned in it. I have guys who tell me things like, well, Ken, I'm not quite sure what this stuff is about, and I'm not quite sure how I do it, and I'm... And like the 11th said, when the people get talking about that, and they say, like, I don't know quite what it says. I said, well, you know, it says things like, when you retire at night. Now, when do you think that might be? Like, you brushed your teeth and you're getting ready to go to bed. Could be retiring, huh? And upon awakening, like, my God, the alarm goes off and your eyes are open, and you say, wow! It's upon awakening already, you know? You know, people make this thing so complicated, it's like watching them milk a mouse. You know? It's a lot of activity, but very little milk, you know? Very little milk. And the deal is that it's because we have this mind, I hear people share continually, you know, my mind says this, and my mind says that, and my mind... If your mind is running your life to that degree, then it's not your mind. You're its body, you know? If it's giving you that much information, then it's running you. You wouldn't take that crap from your hand, you know? Hey, I'm going to go get a soda, not without me, you know? You know, you just wouldn't do that. And I hear guys that want to fight every step because they just don't know they're delusional. People say, well, I have trouble with that third step because I'm turning everything over. You know, and if I turn everything over, Ken, the book even says, I'll become like a hole in the donut. Watch my lips. We are the hole in the donut. And thank God we are, because donuts come and go, but the hole is always there. You know? So the hole is always there. You know? And the thing is, we're connected to something that's so much bigger than ourselves that we can't imagine it, because what could be bigger than me? You know? And And the whole deal is, after you hear a while, you just get to see it, you know, and you got to take the newcomer and congratulations to the people, 10 days or less. I always feel sorry for the person who gets the book, because that person has to go home and tell, yeah, I was at this meeting, and there were several hundred people there, and they applauded me because I'm 62 seconds sober, and they gave me a book, and they said, oh God, she must have got some new crap she's on. What is this? Who would believe that story? You know, who would believe that alcoholics would give a book and congratulate somebody for being newly sober? You just don't think like that. That's just not the world. And I heard several people mention drugs this weekend. I never use drugs. Now, I don't have a big thing with drugs because I know that people have used them. But I never use drugs. I never use legal drugs or illegal drugs. I grew up in the neighborhood where if there were a mafia, this would be their neighborhood. You know? And I know there's no mafia. And they had a simple deal. The first time I grew up in the 50s, 40s, and the first time they caught you using drugs, they would open a car door and close it on your hand. And the second time you used drugs, we just assumed you moved to Jersey, you know? Because we never saw you again, you know? So what happened to Vinny? I think he moved over to Jersey, you know what I mean? You know, he's not here, that's for sure, you know? And it was one of those neighborhoods where everybody's name was a Phony, a Philly, a Joey, you know. And we were like, we had no drugs and we had no crime. Of course, we were crime. You know, like, you can't have crime if there's crime already there, you know. And so nothing got stolen, nothing got moved around, and everything was just the way it was. And we grew up in that neighborhood with a really good sense of security. And all I can tell you is that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was none too soon. None too soon. I did not get here on a winning streak. And I think of my sponsor, and you know, with the stuff he had to put up with me, because, you know, my mom would walk through the living room, unlike moms today, and if the TV were off, she'd make me turn it on. My mom did not want me sitting there pondering anything. You know, she used to say, "You thinking?" I say, "I said, turn on that TV." You know, I don't care what you watch, but get it on, because I could do wonderful things in my head. You know, I just had that capacity, and I had my own perception of things. You know, the way I saw it would maybe not be the way the rest of the world saw it. And I remember I was newly sober, and my sponsor, God love him, who, as I said, is not doing all that great right now, but he had me over his house and every night for dinner, but he didn't call me for dinner. He'd say, come on over here, we got to clean the garage, or we got to do this, and whatever it was to get me over there. And then once I was, are the angels calling or something? Okay. Before, when the lights went, I thought I had a brain tumor, like, what was going on here? But the deal is that he said to me, come on over, and I'd go over there, and I'd hang out with him, and we'd kind of do dinner, and then we'd go to a meeting. And in our neighborhood, we didn't do like 12-step work. They used to say, go put the hit on this guy. And I remember I was about, 35, 40 days sober, and he gets a phone call, and he said, we got to go put the hit on this guy. So we went to this guy's place. Now, in the city, a lot of time, it's tough to get a parking space. So it was the summer. You figure, I got sober July 5th of 70, so it was maybe August sometime. And we pulled up on the street, and anyway, make a long story short, there was no parking spaces. And so he said, I think what I'll do is drive around the block. And then he looked at me, and for the first time since I've known him, he asked me to do something. He said, can you go in there and get that guy? And I said, sure, I can go get that guy. And he said, are you sure you can go get him? I said, yeah, I can go get him. So he said, okay, go get him. Well, in my neighborhood, when you tell somebody you're going to do it, you just do it. Whatever the consequences, you've committed to it, you do it. So he tells the story that he drove around the block, and when he came back up, I had the guy on the ground, and I'm beating him with a garbage can lid, you know, bong, bong, off the side of his head. And what had happened was, somehow this guy thought he had free will. And And since he had called, he had changed his mind about going to the meeting. And what he didn't know is I had committed to my sponsor that I could get him and take him to the car. So his wife came to the door first, and she said, Paul changed his mind. I said, let me see Paul for a minute, you know. So I had snagged Paul through the door, and there was a garbage can lid there. In the city, they call that a friendly persuader. So I gave him like three shots up the side of the head, and I'm just banging him with this garbage can lid, and my sponsor whistled me back to the car like I was a retriever. So I said, what about Paul? Leave him, just... So I ran and I got in the car and we pulled away and we were driving for about three blocks. He didn't say anything and he said, I want you to do me two favors. And I said, what's that? He said, first, don't ever consider that a 12-step call. He said, and secondly, don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor just yet. You know, like, let's take a peek and see how this thing goes later on, you know? And so that was my start. And, you know, I always had a way of inhaling stuff. I didn't learn to read right away, but I learned to memorize. And so I memorized a lot of stuff, but I couldn't read until finally I got with a teacher who took me aside and said, you know, you memorize, you don't read. And then I learned to read, and I became an avid reader. I really enjoy reading. I don't know why. I don't watch much TV or the news or any of that stuff because I just don't watch it. But I do a lot of reading, and I really, really enjoy it. And I enjoy inhaling stuff. And I was looking at your little deal that you guys put up here. Is the person who did this in the room by any chance? Okay. Because I was going to say there's so much symbolism here. I was sitting down there looking at this Bainbridge paddle boat on the Flint River. And I thought, at some point, the eye of God must have noticed that there was a river of alcoholism. And that eye of God said, I'm going to need a craft to get us through that. And what he did was he needed two pillars to build on. So he took Bob and Bill, and he put them in there, and he gave them the triangle for each of them to work with. And that was recovery, unity, and service. And they would be the base of the service. And he knew there was going to have to be a power source besides him on the earth. So he said, I'll give you 12 windows. I'll make those the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as you look out onto that sea of alcoholism from the safety of this craft, you'll get to see what it used to be like, what happened, and what it can be like now. And eventually, if you follow this thing right through to the end, you'll have a gangplank that you'll be able to set down on any spiritual aisle you come to, and you'll be able to live a life of total serenity and peace. And we'll call it Alcoholics Anonymous, a vessel for everybody. And instead of worrying about who's surviving from off the boat, let's get everybody on the boat. And the deal was is that when I see the world today, I see it through the world of somebody in recovery who has recovered. I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Therefore, I don't have to worry about what happened yesterday, because that's why they call it yesterday. You know? And I don't have to worry about tomorrow, because that's why they call it tomorrow. I'm doing the 15th. I'm going to beat the heck out of the 15th. And when I'm done with it, there'll be nothing left. There'll be nothing left. I mean, Creighton and I got off to a good start this morning. I mean, we ate and then we drove. And I mean, we were working on that 15th all day long. And the bottom line is that you don't have to be what you used to be. And I've learned, too, from volunteering in the hospice program and being with people when they die, that when people are dying, I never heard one person say, well, you know, there's things I wish I hadn't done. They're mostly talking about things what? They wish they had done. And the deal is now the window is closing and suddenly there's a sense of urgency. And it lets me know if you can, like if you were to write down the 10 things that are most important to you right now, and then a week from now somebody were to tell you you only had 30 days to live or 60 days to live, you would throw that list away and you would come up with a whole new list because you'd have a different sense of priority. It wouldn't be about all the nonsense, it would be about something else. And I realized that life is just too short to waste on yesterday. And it's really too short to waste on worrying about tomorrow. So you get on with it. You know, you just get on with it. And you have a lot of fun. I mean, I don't know how you can come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and not have fun. I mean, you look around the room and you say, not only are we people who would not mix, we're people who wouldn't be invited. You know, like, it's just that way, you know. I mean, it seemed to me that every one of the ideas that I prefaced with, I have a good idea, was usually followed minimum by a court appearance, you know. And the deal is that, you know, I just found out in life that the reason it wasn't working for me was because I was like swimming against the tide. And then I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous through taking the steps that I could swim with the tide. And what the steps did for me was they evicted me from my hiding places, and it showed me who I really was for the first time. And seeing who I was, I now had a chance to deal with something in reality. You know, the book talks about a great length fear. When I first read this, you know, we're driven by 100 forms of fear. I used to thought, these guys are really dramatic. You know, 100 forms of fear, abnormal fear, unreasonable fear, you know, fear of this. Fear. Now I think we underestimate it. Because it seems as though fear drives most of us throughout most of our lives. And the book says our fabric is shot through with it. We're just shot through with fear. And it also says in the 12 and 12 that freedom from fear, we think, is more important than freedom from want. You know, and that freedom from fear comes when you start living in the moment, because that's when you live with God. God hangs out in the now. And when you're living in the now, you're hanging out with God. And when you're not in the now, you're just on your own. And that's the spiritual malady. You start to get further and further away from reality. I sponsor a psychiatrist, which is a joke unto itself. And the reason it's a joke is because he's a nice guy. And he's a brilliant guy. But like some people who have gotten education, he's vested to that education. And therefore, it's like you have to know everything. And we're just not going to know everything. If you put the burden on yourself to know everything, you're in big trouble. I mean, the other day there was an article in the paper. It said that we represent, meaning the United States, we represent 4% of the world's population. And we consume 68% of the world's drugs. So that ought to tell you that we have a spiritual malady that runs kind of rampant here, because folks just don't know what they're attached to. They don't know what sustains them. And not knowing what sustains them, they make stuff up. I just know that for me, when I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew something good was happening. But I also knew at the time a little bit that I was a little wacko. You have to remember, I got sober in July of 70, and Bill Wilson died in January of 71. And I called my sponsor and I said, wow, I said, you know, the owner died. And I guess they're not going to have meetings anymore. And he said, no, I talked around to some of the people. They're going to try to keep the meetings going for a while. You know? And the deal was, is that was my insanity. My insanity was I didn't know that stuff. And I looked at my life situation, and my life situation was such that when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in the process of going to jail. I had a habit of finding things before people officially lost them. And I met up with a guy who was a few days sober more than me, but he had a Cadillac. And at that time, Cadillacs were the car. That was the symbol of success. You owned a Cadillac. And he would take me to meetings. And I was tired of my other sponsor already because he wanted me to do a lot of stuff. So I said to Tommy, would you be my sponsor? And he said, no, we'll just go to meetings together. He said, I'm not much further ahead than you in this sobriety thing. And you're with a guy who has a lot of sobriety. At that time, he had 7 years. And he said, you need that. And then finally, when it came time to work this deal out, this jackpot I had gotten myself into, and this was really a spiritual experience for me, was I went into a scenario where I had to appear before the district attorney. And in the city, it's not like in Podunk Center, you know, there's like 150 to 200 attorneys in the district attorney's office. And I went into this guy's office, and who's sitting behind the desk but the guy I was going to meetings with? And he looked up and he said, "I didn't know you did this." And I said, "I sure as hell didn't know you did this when we were riding around sharing." You know, like, you know, I didn't know that. And so, since it was all financial, he said, "Maybe we can get the detective involved who's involved to maybe work something out. Let me get him in here." And they brought in the guy who was the detective. And it was a guy I played football with in high school. And he said to me, "If you own up to this, you know, and don't give us any hassle on it, well, I'll work with you. Did you do it?" And of course, I was really into rigorous honesty at the time, and of course I said no, you know. Might have been somebody who looked like me, but it wasn't me. And so he said, "Well, I'm gonna walk away from this," he said, "because I don't want to be the guy to send you back to the sneezer." And as he started to walk out of the room, I stopped him, and I said, "Yeah, I did that. I'm the guy." And between the three of us, we worked that deal out so that the first 18, almost 19 years of my sobriety, I made financial restitution for that. But I didn't go to jail. And that was an experience that got my eyes open that there's something happening all the time that I don't see. And just because I don't see it doesn't mean it isn't happening. You know, I've been to enough magic shows to see the magician pull the rabbit out of the hat. And by the time you see the rabbit, you've missed the trick. You know, even the slowest person in the room sees the rabbit. The idea is to know there was a trick involved. And I began to realize that there was some force that was operating out there that was doing something that just couldn't be done by mere mortals. And I went through a whole series of those things. And you know, I just knew that good things would happen. And they did. I mean, I actually got a place to move in on my own. And I was living with my mom when I got sober in a senior citizen place. And they told us one of us would have to move, and since she was the senior citizen. But I had been there so long, I got good with the walker. You know, I could like, I was a pretty good senior, and I wasn't even half eligible. And the bottom line is that those kind of things began to happen, and I got a place on my own, and my sponsor came to visit me. And the only thing I got when my wife and I were separated and filed for divorce was my mom had given us a Hummel when we got married, and my wife said, "You better keep that." So I had this Hummel. Now, my place was really classy. It was like, you know, in a place where they shoot drugs in the hall, and I had orange crates for like end tables, you know, those fancy things with the Tangelo logo still on it, you know. And I had a little lamp on the one, and then I had a little, you know, cushion on the floor because you were going to have to sit on the floor. And my sponsor came to visit me, and he brought me one of these hot plates that you could make coffee with. And he said, "You'll need this if you're going to stay sober." And he went to sit down, and I had my little Hummel right there on the orange crate. And he went to sit down, and I said, "Whoa, whoa." I said, "Be careful." He said, "Why?" I said, "I don't want you to break my Hummel." So he picked it up, and he said, "This Hummel?" I said, "Yeah." And he threw it. And it hit the plaster wall and just splattered all over the place. And he said, "Now you don't have to worry about anything, you know." He said, "Somebody break in now, they'd leave you something, you know, like that. You don't own a thing." And I thought, at first, I'm not real happy right at the moment. And when I usually wasn't very happy, usually I had a reaction that I got into, and I'm thinking, you know, and I'm moving back and forth, and he said, don't even think about it. He said, I did that because you're going to have to learn at some point that you only need one attachment and one relationship, and that's with a power greater than yourself. That Hummel isn't going to do anything for you. And I don't know why, but I bought it. I bought it. And when I bought it down to the depths of my soul. I knew something good had just happened, because after that, when I went in and out, I didn't have this fear of coming through the door and seeing if the Hummel was still there. You know? It was there, but was like not collected. It was, you know, it was kind of in pieces. And the nice part about that is that when I was 25 years sober, I got a United Parcel Post thing at my house, and I went to the door, and it was from my sponsor, and I brought it in, and I opened it up, and it was a Hummel, and it was one that had been broken, and he had it all taped together. You know, he had the head where the arm should be, and it said, it had a little card that said, "Good things come for those who wait," and the deal was is that I understood right away that things were not important. It was the people and the action that I was going to do that was important. And I got that down inside of me enough to know that this is what I should start to do. I hear people say, and everything that people say, when I say I hear people say, it's not like I'm opposed to that. I'm just saying I thought that way too. And then I had other experiences, and then I didn't have that thought anymore. So I guess I'm trying to offer encouragement, not judgment, that you, as you're here longer, you're going to see things very differently. And you're going to see them very differently because you're going to have more energy to do things than you ever thought possible. You know, that whole 11th step is talking about, and the 12th step is talking about what? We won't be so undisciplined anymore. We won't be worn out. We'll have a new energy. We won't fatigue that quickly. In the 12 and 12, it says when you do the 12th step, a wonderful energy is released. That wonderful energy is the spiritual energy we all have inside of us. If you look at the word spiritual and look at it closely, you'll see inside of the word spiritual is the word ritual, R-I-T-U-A-L. And as you stay here longer, you realize in order to be spiritual, there are certain rituals that I have to do. I have to go to meetings. I have to do service. I have to live by principles. I have to work with others. I have to not be judgmental. I have to do all of these things that in many cases were not originally part of my nature, or so I thought. And then it hit me one day that even that is made up. Even that part of it is made up. I was sent out from the home office okay. You know, the problems that happened to me didn't come in the making, it came in the breaking. And I just did life differently than I should have. And it wasn't like I didn't know better. My mom didn't raise me to be a fool. I just, you know, thought I should practice on my own. And that's how I got into that stuff. And my mom was just one of these women who was a single mom. My dad died when we were young. She was a seamstress. She had no education. And she loved us, and she just did the best she could. And her best was darn good. You know, it wasn't an easy thing raising seven kids who were all going in different directions. And the thing was is that I could see that life was pretty much what you want it to be. If you want it to be miserable, it's going to be miserable, you know. But if you want it to be happy, it can be happy. And the book talks about that. You know, God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. In fact, you got it on your flyer. You know, we're not a glum lot. We're supposed to be having a good time. And, you know, you see some people and you just say, wow, you know, they missed their calling. They should have been hemorrhoids. No matter what you say, they have something negative to say. You know, yeah. Well, this is the best meal I ever had. Yeah, I had one here last week. Stunk, you know. And they always got something on the downside. So what I've learned to do is just realize that's who they are, and they're going to have to be that way until that's not who they are. But that doesn't mean that I have to be that way. And the nice part about this whole thing is you get to do life on the natural. I never knew you could do life on the natural. We have a guy, he's passed away now, but he was the oldest guy. This is the kind of things we do in San Diego. He was the oldest living member in Alcoholics Anonymous in San Diego. He was 55 years sober. and he slipped and broke his hip, 93 years old, slipped and broke his hip, ended up in a convalescent home, and once he was out of his own environment, he became very disoriented. And so he was getting into a deep depression. Didn't matter how many of us went to visit him, he was just getting into a deep depression. So his grandkids called and said, is there something you can do to help him? I know you're going to see him. Something you can do to help him. So what we decided to do was to go pick him up on a Sunday, and we took him down to one of those girly bars, and we got him a lap dance. Now, here's a guy 93 years old with a broken hip, and he already had a heart attack. And we went into this place, and they made us sign off on this thing, and saying that no matter what happened, it would be okay. And we went home, and about 3 weeks later, he passed away. And at his memorial service, his grandkids said, you know, of all the things he did in his life, that's all he talked about for the last 3 weeks. And the deal is that's what you got to do. You got to become creative. I mean, you just don't want to lose everything, you know. You just don't want to give up on everything. You want to remain creative. I don't know where this came from, but last year I got it in my head that I needed to stop doing everything I was doing and become more centered spiritually. And so the way I did that, and I don't recommend it to anyone, is that, I mean, it worked for me, but it's not for everyone, is I gave away everything I owned, sold my place, and I moved away with nothing but 6 boxes in the back of my SUV. And I went up into the mountains, and I did a month silent retreat. And then I went down and I hung out with the Navajo over in Colorado and New Mexico. And I got my little Indian name, Click Clock, which means white pony man. And so I was Click Clock for about 8 months. And it was a great thing for me. And the people were so great. I mean, they were just so open and giving and kind. And what I found out in doing that was that I had become unknowingly attached to some things more than I should have been. And after a while, it wasn't like I owned them. It was more like they owned me. And they prevented me from doing certain other things. And by getting rid of all of that and getting away from it for 8 months, it was a chance to restore myself to sanity in a lot of different ways. Now, people in my family said, you know, we had a family meeting, and none of them are in AA, but they need it. We had a family meeting, and we think you've lost your mind. And I thanked them for the compliment. And I said, it hasn't happened yet, but trust me, I'm working on it. You know, I'm doing the best I can. But I went over there, and then I still had these things that I was doing, going out and speaking. So I had to fly out of a little tiny airport in Farmington, New Mexico. It's in the Four Corner area. It's a real, like, it makes the Tallahassee airport look like LaGuardia or Kennedy, you know, real, real small. And when all this other nonsense started happening, it impacted that area too. And so there's a guy over there, you know, and his name was Don. And Don would check you in here, and then he walked over, and he was the same guy who did your luggage. And then when the little tiny plane landed, there was only 2 planes in and out of there a day, like 12 of you got on there. He was the guy who you had to show your passport or ID again to before he let you on the plane. And he was getting a little obsessive, you know what I mean? And I have always packed the same way. I'm a man who does the same thing, some things the same over and over again because it's easy. And whenever I travel and I take a hair dryer, I always wrap it in my underwear. So he would open my valise and my hair dryer looked threatening to him. So he would always pull it out and my underwear would kind of just go through the air. And then I went to pick it up the first time. He said, "Oh, under FAA regulations, you can't touch anything until I'm done." So I waited, and then I picked up my underwear, and I wrapped it around my hair dryer, put it... Well, this happened the very next week. And now, again, not that many people are traveling. I'm not talking about trying to lose track of someone on Times Square. This is like 18 people a day over 5 days, you know. It's not overwhelming, you know. And the next time I did it, he did the same thing. I don't know why that really bothered me. I thought, I got to pray about this because I don't like this happening. So the next few days I prayed about it, and when you really relax, you get some good thoughts. And I was really relaxed. So I went down to the Target, and I bought the biggest pair of Big Mama pink panties. And I took this Big Mama pink panties, and I wrapped it around the dryer. And the next time Don and I met, he opened my valise, pulled out the hairdryer, and those pink panties just whirled through the air and fell on the ground. And he looked at me and he said, "You can get those and put them back in." And I said, "I don't need to. I have another pair." And the lady behind me was laughing so hard, she backed up through the security and her husband had to come get her. But I still don't like people pressing me too much, you know? And the deal is that I get a chance today to do things in a way that at least I don't get arrested. You know, I found out you could leave to take stuff that they touch, so now I just leave that, you know? And I like the idea of having a little humor with my humor. And the deal is for me is that as I go through life today, I realize that if you're around people that are laughing and shucking and jiving, then the chances are they're not hurting anybody. It's the folks who are plotting and planning and concerned that, you know, that have me. I sponsor a guy. He's from Persia, which is Iran. But he never wants to tell anybody he's Iranian. So he tells everybody he's, "I'm Persian." And so I had a guy during football season who just wanted to get, you know, I guess find out something from me. And he called me and he said, "My sponsor told me to come talk to you about God. Of having trouble with God." And the guys used to come over on Monday night. We'd get pizza and we'd watch Monday night football. So Sam was already there. And, of course, he has to pray 6 times a day. So he has a little prayer rug and he goes in my bedroom. And unbeknownst to me, this other guy comes a little early, too. And he knocks at the door and I let him in. And I don't even think to mention that Sam's in the bedroom. So this guy comes in and he's sitting on the couch and he said, "My sponsor said to talk to you about God, and I'd like to talk to you about God." And he told me, "I have a lot of problems with God." And he started in all that God problem stuff. And just about then we hear, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa," you know, coming out of the bedroom. And he says to me, "What the hell is that?" I said, "Oh, that's just Sam talking to his higher power." Well, he left. And I haven't seen him since. And neither has his sponsor. You know, he just left, you know. And the nice thing is, that's what you want to do. You know, those that you can help, you want to help. And those that you can't, you just can't. And the deal with life is that what I found out for me is that it just doesn't always work the way you think. I was able to retire when I was fairly young because I had a company that I sold to a very large insurance company, and I was retired about 10 years, and that insurance company went belly up. And so I lost my pension plan, and it was like I had never gone out the door to work a day in my life. I had to start all over again. And I was substantially older at that point. And that same year, my son, who was traveling around the world on a cruise ship singing and doing what he always wanted to do, came home to me, and when he got home, he was in full-blown AIDS. And he arrived home in July, and on the 8th, and he was dead the day after Labor Day, September the 7th. And during that period of time, when my wife and I divorced, those two boys stayed with me. So I got to go. That was the deal for the retirement, I'm sure. I got to go to see the sports and to school events. And be a real good dad in terms of getting a chance to do things that a lot of dads, just because their work schedules don't allow, don't get to do. Having no idea that the window of his and mine being together was going to be so short. And when that was happening, I had a whole new insight into God, because it's a very unbelievable disease. It comes in a different form every day, and one time he'd be cold, the next time he'd be hot. He had Kaposi sarcoma, he had brain tumors. I mean, it was just not a great thing. And during that time, I knew God had a sense of humor, because my ex-wife started coming to my house. And I got to meet my husband-in-law. And it was a scenario where, you know, it was just so very different. But we had a major task to do, and everything else was set aside. All those trivial things were just set aside. And my son had neuropathy so bad that he just couldn't have anything on his legs. And then it reached a point where he wanted to maintain his dignity, so he would crawl to the bathroom. And I would put comforters and pillows on the floor, and the bathroom was only maybe 10, 15 feet from his bed, but it would take him an hour sometimes to crawl across the floor to get there, because he would nap in between and use up his energy. And one day I was watching him crawl, which is not what a parent plans to do for a child they brought into this world. And as he was crawling across the floor, it came to me that in my lifetime I had crawled on the floor and lost my dignity. And my son was crawling on the floor to save his dignity. So I learned that the action itself is neither good nor bad, it's why you're there. And I got a chance to see him do things that I just thought were amazing for a 29-year-old boy. And finally, he ended up in the very hospice where I volunteered for 10 years. And doctors had said basically there was nothing they could do for him. And there was a day when he was just laying there. We don't know what happened. We moved him from the hospital where he was in a coma to this hospice, and we stopped all the medication. And when we stopped the medication, something happened where he had about an hour and 45 minutes of a window where he was totally coherent. And he opened his eyes and he wanted to know where he was and what was going on. And at that time I had to tell him that he was in the hospice and that he wasn't going to make it. And he took his head and he rolled it to one side of the pillow. And I had always heard when I was young, going to parochial school, that there are people who are in this world, and then there are people sometimes of this world. And when he rolled his head over, he was a person who was in this world. But when he rolled his head back, he was a person of this world. And I told him, I said, you know, you've taken enough with this thing, it's time to let go, and, you know, your mom and I are here, and we're real proud of you, and we love you. And he responded the same way. And he said something to me at that time, which I'll never forget. He looked me direct in the eyes and he said, Dad, you have to go on with your life. And no matter what happens, you have to go on with your life. And he said, I want you to know that I'm good to go. I'm good to go with this deal. And from that point to today, I've spent my life to the best of my ability being good to go. Because I know that can happen at any time, as we all do listening to the news, that we're only, you know, one minute you're here and the next minute you're not. And being good to go means getting out and doing those things that you know you should do. And it means being willing sometimes, you know, God's will sometimes is very inconvenient. You know, getting on planes anymore and traveling whole days to get to places is just not fun. But the bottom line is that when I get here, there's a lot of fun. And even the trip itself is fun because you make it fun. You know, you have pink panties or you do whatever you got to do. And you realize that we all just have this very moment, which is what I started with. And that's why this moment is so very important. And that
if you have somebody in your life, I shared this with somebody, I think, the other night, but if you have another human being in your life, there's only three things that can happen to that human being. And that human being can die, they can change, or they can leave. That's it. There are no other options. So unless you want to live alone in a cave by yourself, then you have to accept the fact that this is all about impermanence. It's not about permanence. And the thing that it seems to me when I hear people are having trouble, particularly in relationships, they're having trouble because they're trying to make something permanent that is really only designed for today. And it's designed for today as long as you have the todays. It's not designed for 30 years out or 50 years out. You know, man is the only one in the entire natural world who would have the audacity to make plastic flowers. You know, nature doesn't do it. Makes it to come and be here and go. And the deal is as you become aware of those things, life itself becomes more enjoyable because you realize that this is the everything that we have. And you get so you can really live life to the max. I mean, I see a lot of folks who are looking for, you know, when it comes to relationships, they're looking for a custom fit in an off-the-rack world, you know. And the bottom line is that there's no one out there who's perfect. You know, there's just people out there who are just who they are. We had a play in San Diego, ran for 2.5 years, and the title of the play was, I Love You Just the Way You Are, Now Change. You know, and that seems to be the deal, is that we feel that somehow we know what somebody else should be. And what I have found out from reading all the stuff that Bill Wilson wrote and all the AA literature I could find is it's about a total surrender. You know, we talk about pain being the touchstone of all spiritual growth. But pain is the delivery system. If you just stay in the pain, nothing happens. Sooner or later, you have to surrender. The spiritual growth comes when you're able to look at the world and say, whatever happens at this moment, I'll be okay with. And once you can say that, then this world takes on a different glow. As Chuck C. said, a new pair of glasses. You can have that new pair of glasses right here and now. Don't have to wait for anything. And it's not about what people call you. You know, I was fortunate to live in New York when Malcolm X was talking. And I went to hear old brother Malcolm one day. And he said something that still rings in my ears. And he said, it's not about what people call you. It's what you answer to. And you have to learn sooner or later who you are so that no matter what anybody else is saying or doing, you just realize, you know, forgive them, Father. They don't have a clue. And the deal is that life gets really simple then. And I enjoy coming out to these things because, as I said, I love to meet the people, and some old friends, some new friends, and I love to hear people laugh because I know that in that laughter is a relief that all of us could use. And once you hear yourself laugh, it's kind of like, how serious can it be? You know, we have guys that they don't get depressed anymore since we started a new thing about 8 years ago, and that is if you call and you tell somebody, well, I'm depressed, man. You know, you're getting into that stuff. Now, I'm not talking about clinical depression. I'm talking about, you know, made-up stuff, phantom stuff. You know. Well, if we say if you're going to have a pity party, your friends should come over. So we dress up in costumes and go over your house, you know. And the last thing you don't want is 30 or 40 of us out there blowing horns, you know, New Year's Eve stuff and acting stupid on your front lawn because, you know, you're having a pity party inside. You know? So the end result is that we take a lot of that steam out of that because somebody will say, you know, I'm really not No. Actually, it's not all that bad, you know. And the deal is that you learn to have a lot of good laughs. I mean, I was thinking of the young people who had less than 10 days. You guys are in for the ride of your life, you know, because if you think this 15th is amazing, wait till you wake up tomorrow for the 16th. I mean, it's like, wow, here's another one looks just as good as the one we had yesterday, you know? And after a while, you stop scratching shit that don't itch. And, you know, You know, and you just get on with having a good time, you know. I love working with newcomers because, you know, they have that look, like, you know. You know, they're kind of looking at it. And it's kind of like the hamster's dead, but the wheel is still turning, you know. And you know there'll be momentum there for at least a couple of years, you know. And the dynamic of that is you just get to have a good time. And you realize that in AA, nobody knows any more than you do. Absolutely. Somebody, well, I like to talk to the old-timers because they know. We don't know any more than you. The only thing is we're not trying to pretend like we do. You know? And when you stop telling people you don't know, trust me, they'll stop asking you questions. You know, like, people will say, what do you, I don't know anything. I don't think I ever did know anything, and I'm not too sure of the things I know, you know. And they'll just stop asking you those questions. And after a while, you start to really just have a good time. I mean, things are just misnamed. I mean, I always had trouble with things that were misnamed. In my refrigerator, I have a thing. It's called a crisper. It should be called a rotter. You know, anything I put in there, I eventually end up throwing out because somehow I forget it's in there, you know. So it's entirely misnamed, you know. Had James Brown gotten a little bit more education, he'd be singing, I feel well. Just, you know, you just say certain things just don't go together, you know? And the nice part about it is after a while, you just realize you're connected to everything. Several years ago, I was driving through San Diego. I always had a fear of dogs. Always had a fear of dogs. It seemed like I was bit 3 or 4 times because I was trying to get into places where they were trying to keep you out. And so I had this real fear of dogs. And I was riding down the street on this little side street, and I looked in my mirror, and there was this huge Rottweiler. You know, these dogs are huge. And this Rottweiler was stomping after my car, and it's like a Rottweiler. What'd I say? Rottweiler. You can tell what I know about dogs. I know they bite. And I looked in the mirror, and here was this Rottweiler. Is that the way you say it? Rottweiler. And that's like a Doberman on steroids. You know, it's a huge, huge, just coming along. And I saw him in my side view mirror, and I pulled over. And I put down the window, and I let him catch up with me. And I looked at him as he was there. And I looked at him, and I said, what now? And he looked at me. And just for that moment, he and I were on the same page. You know, he knew I had chased after stuff all my life, not knowing what I was going to do when I caught it. And we had this great eye contact, you know, for about maybe half a minute. Then I said, hey, hang in there. You know, like, maybe there'll be a Volkswagen coming or something. You know, and I left. And I thought, that's just the way it is. I mean, I get along with everything. You know, I just get along with everything. I was coming out of an apartment, and I tripped, and I almost fell down the stairs, and somehow, I don't know how I did it yet, I did some kind of a little flip, and I landed on this landing. And both feet like a perfect 10, you know, boom. And there was a cat there. And I know that cat looked at me and said, hey, nice landing, you know. I just know that stuff today, you know. I just know that's what's going on. You know, life is like being involved in everything. Everything is alive and everything is okay. And that's why I like to see people bring kids to these things because, you know, kids are the most at ease. I mean, it's amazing because they haven't gotten all the rules yet, thank God. And they're not like newcomers, you know. And they're just so relaxed. I mean, I saw a kid in the elevator scratching his head, and I said, why are you scratching your head? He said, because I'm the only one who knows it itches. And, you know, those are the kind of things that make me know I'm alive and in the moment, you know? And for those of you who came out to San Diego for the 1995 International Convention, we had a scenario. We have a nice place there called Seaport Village. And in Seaport Village, they fly kites. The kids go there and they fly kites and they go out over the water. And they fly these huge kites that sometimes you can move all different ways and stuff. And there was a kid there. He's about 10 years old. And he was flying this kite. And I walked by, and it was one of those days where we had low clouds. And I said to him, "How do you know your kite's still there?" And that kid looked at me and he said, "'Cause I can feel the pull of it, mister." And I thought, great answer. Great answer. See, when I'm doing God's will, I can feel the pull of it. And when I'm not doing God's will, it has its own pull. And I can tell one from the other today. And I know that when I'm doing God's work, there's a pull there that's really, really relaxing. And when I'm not doing God's work, when I'm self-centered, selfish, doing all those things, saying no to things that I should be saying yes to, and saying yes to things I should be saying no to, I feel that pull too. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I needed a sponsor when I was in kindergarten. I needed someone to call and talk to when I was in kindergarten, because I just didn't feel like I was in step. You know, I needed someone to call and have them reinforce me, like say, you know, "Ken, eat the cookies, take the nap," you know. And then that way I would have felt okay. I thought I found bliss, perfect spiritual bliss, several months ago. I rented a car and it had a global positioning system in it, which I didn't know anything about. And I programmed it the way I was instructed to, and then it was snowing where I was at, so I had to drive it through a car wash to get the car cleaned off. And so I drove it through the car wash, and in the process of doing that, I was pointing it in the wrong direction. And when I came out, this voice came on, and it says, "Please follow directions." And I thought, where were you when I really needed you? You know, like, where were you when I really needed you? You know, when I was growing up and I had had that kind of voice come in all the time, you know, you would have a different speaker tonight. But I couldn't muster that. I would get a good idea. I never had a bad idea. I would get a good idea, which usually, as I said, meant I was going to appear in night court. And the bottom line of all of that was everything that happened, it doesn't matter how I value it, whether I value it good, bad, or indifferent, it has brought me to this point today where I'm in Bainbridge, Georgia. It's March the 15th. It's my day. It's your day. You know, we don't have to worry about what used to be, because that isn't happening anymore. Don't have to worry about all that phantom fear, you know. What happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? Well, that's a great way to spend the day, you know. Go to bed exhausted and you accomplished absolutely nothing. You say, "Wow, I have another day like that. I don't know if I can take it," you know. You know, sometimes you got to get out of the lazy boy. It's not called lazy boy for nothing, you know. You got to get out of it. You got to go do something. And it doesn't matter whether you do it right or not. It's going to be okay. Because in the long run, as long as you're in motion, you'll tend to stay in motion. And I'm glad that you guys invited me to come here. I really love this part of the South because I love the way you talk like, "Hey, Ken." In New York, you say, "Hey, yo," you know. "Hey, yo." And then when I was in Canada 2 years ago working, they say, "Hey," at the end of a sentence. They say something and they go, "Hey?" And I said, "You're just like New Yorkers, except you have it out of place. It should be at the beginning," you know. And the main thing is to relax. You know, Monday is St. Patrick's Day. Now, St. Patrick is credited with taking all the snakes out of Ireland. There were never any snakes in Ireland. Now, that's what you want, have a holiday for a guy who did absolutely nothing but gets a lot of praise. You know, kind of like Columbus. He didn't know where he was twice, but he's got a day, you know. And that comes back to the deal that as long as you're doing something, you may luck out. You know? You know? You may be the guy who has his own day for accomplishing absolutely nothing. You know? But at least you're in there taking the pitch, you know, and that's the big thing. And again, our job here, as I see it more and more clearly, is very simple in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's to remember that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God could and would if he was sought. And to be, our primary purpose is to be of service to one another. And realize that the people you're working with, newcomers in particular, they don't surrender easy. They don't write lines in the book like, the alcoholic has to be mangled. Mangled. I looked up that word, mangled. It says tear, crush, you know. It's like tearing a bone is mangling, you know. And that's what has to happen before we begin to get a clue that we want to change something. And the other thing is about 10 years ago, and I'm not upset at any of this stuff anymore because I know it comes and it goes, but the word denial started getting into Alcoholics Anonymous, and now it's used a lot, denial, denial, denial. I have no problem with it, but that's not what our literature says. Our literature says we are delusional. Delusional. Now, if you're so inclined, go look up the two words. Denial is, I know the truth, but I don't want to tell you. Look up delusional. This is why it's our word. It says psychotic thought, where the individual involved has no clue as to what reality is. You know, there's a big difference between, hey, I'm in denial and I'm in delusion. I mean, there's a big difference. In our group, if you say you're in denial, we think that's spiritual growth. You know, like, you've just come from delusion. You know, you're heading towards rigorous honesty, you know. You're on the path. And good luck. Hope it works out for you, you know. And as I said, I want to thank you guys for having me here. I hope I didn't say anything that could help you. And I mean that because your help isn't going to come from any human being, and my help isn't going to come from any human being. It's going to come from a power greater than ourselves. And the nice part about it is while we don't have a whole lot of power, you know, the book says lack of power is our dilemma. And there's also a flip side of that. Lack of dilemma is our power. If you're not there on a daily basis, you'll be surprised how nice life can be. You find yourself talking to everybody. You just can't wait to see them smile because you know how ugly they look at the time. You can make them smile. I used to like to drive up to the Holland Tunnel in the morning when the traffic was all backed up and say to the guy, I'll have two fries and a large chocolate milkshake. And he'd say, hey, pal, we don't have any of that here. And I'll say, you better get it. The line's really backing up. You know? And you know, any time you can give someone a laugh like that, it's worth the day, you know. I saw a mom pulling her kid through the store not too long ago, and you could tell she was at the end of the day, and she just wanted to get home, and this kid wanted to buy everything in the store. And we were in the ketchup aisle, and, you know, they have Paul Newman ketchup. And I looked at it, and I looked at her, and I said, I didn't even know he was missing, you know. And she just looked at me and just shook her head, you know. So I thought, well, she didn't get that. So when we got in line and I was behind her, she was looking at me, and of course she got into 50, she got into 10 or less item, and it was like 50 items she had, and she paid with a check. And the guy said to her, "What's your phone number?" And I said, "Don't give it to him; he'll never call you." You know, and she just started laughing. And the kid couldn't believe this was the mom laughing. And what it is that, you know, we get a chance every day to give somebody a good hoot. You know, just be yourself. You know, that's hoot enough, you know. And remember that if I say anything tonight of importance, it's this. Is that we have to take really good care of one another because we're only on loan. Everybody is just passing through, and we have to take really good care of one another. There's a spiritual thing that I'll say, and then I'll sit down. And that spiritual thing is, I read it in a book, it's anonymous, one of those great anonymous things, and it says, you cannot catch hold of it, nor can you let go of it. When you are speaking, it's silent. When you are silent, it speaks. God bless you. Love you.